before October, we've watched as every time the Israelis deny their hourly war crimes, the Western leaders then accept whatever they say is the reason why their missiles once again went astray, always giving them the benefit of the doubt, accepting the assumptions what their nation is about, and now watch them justify the missiles that they sent to bomb the starving children dying in their tents. Since long before October, we've seen the government decide clearly, unequivocally in favor of genocide. As the case goes through the court, the judgments are ignored, because as the politicians say, this is a total war. But somehow their pronouncements don't translate in the West, where the conflict is portrayed as complicated at best. And now watch them justify the missiles that they sent to bomb the starving children dying in their tents.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, as Canada observed its colonial foundation, one of its past foreign government assets settled into his new life in an American penitentiary. Strangely, few Canadian media outlets reported former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez's sentencing in the Southern District Federal Court of New York for his role in importing 400 tons of cocaine into the U.S. while in office, among other things. But then perhaps that's not such a surprise, given the role Ottawa played in securing Hernandez's and his predecessor's questionable tenures. Eve Angler is a Montreal-based political activist and the author of 13 books, including Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority with Anthony Fenton, and his latest, co-authored with Owen Schock, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, which he's recently toured across the country. Eve's also a prolific essayist whose writing appears across the internet and at his website, eveangler.com, where I found his recent piece, Canada's Guy in Honduras, Sentenced to 45 years in prison. Welcome back to the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Eve, we're getting to the unhappy Senor Hernandez. Haiti has experienced more than its share of Canada's fight against democracy. What role, Eve, is Canada playing in the current iteration of international assistance to that benighted Caribbean island nation?
Well, Canada's been promoting the Kenya-led policing military mission to the country, which has just begun, I guess, about a week ago now. And about $80 million, I think, is Canada put up for the Kenyan mission. Some of that's been training Jamaican and Barbados and other security personnel in Jamaica. This actually, the mission to Haiti has been kind of a bit embarrassing, because of course there's been major demonstrations in Nairobi and elsewhere in Kenya, and the police killed, now I think the number is saying towards 40 people that were killed in these protests against the IMF imposed tax increase, and I think more general frustration with the Ruto government. So we're sending these Kenyan police that are killing protesters in Nairobi and elsewhere in Kenya to Haiti. They have a fairly dubious rights record. So that's been a sort of an embarrassment for the Trudeau government, and obviously led the Washington-led push for this foreign mission into Haiti, which, of course, you know, the front page of today's Globe and Mail is this picture of the gangs in Haiti, and it's a two-page spread with mostly photos of sort of like the dangerous, you know, gang criminals in Haiti and bull plants and the like, which is the rationale for the foreign mission, which has a bit of legitimacy to it, but it's also part of a broader policy of dominating the country that the U.S. and Canada have pursued very aggressively since overthrowing the elected government in 2004, and then intervening very aggressively in the 2010 elections. Well, first of all, forcing elections immediately after the devastating earthquake, and then when their candidate wasn't in the second round of the runoff, the U.S. and Canada forced, you know, just aggressively forced their candidate into the runoff, and their candidate was Michel Martelly, who was a thuggish individual who is, you know, central figure in the descent of the country over the past 14 years, somebody who was clearly working with all kinds of narco gang kind of criminal world. He was, you know, from that world. And now that's being the further descent of the country is being used to justify a new foreign mission, which is, you know, part of a long legacy of foreign domination of the country. So what we're seeing in Haiti today with this new mission is has a lot of its roots can be found in the 2004 coup, as well as the 2010 intervention to anoint Michel Martelly and his PHTK party the rulers of the country.
The last time we talked, if I'm remembering right, you said, well, you know, it's not so cut and dry, and that there's some, these gangs do need addressing. There needs to be some reining in. It's not all just an excuse from the usual suspects at the core group to move in and militarize once again the situation for their benefit in Haiti.
Yeah, just yesterday, the Haiti Information Project posted some image of story, quite a brutal story of a relative of a gang leader being basically killed by sort of community defense organizations. Bois Calé is, I think, how you say it in Haitian or in so-called Creole. So it is a real problem. I think, you know, most of the gangs do terrorize their local communities. And there is, you know, popular, some degree of organized resistance to this that is, you know, it's a kind of it's a impossible situation, of course, for a local community to resist the gang, because you have to kind of act as a gang to resist the gang. And that's gets you down a sort of dangerous path. But I think it is a real problem. I think it would be a big error to just dismiss this as not a, insecurity is a serious problem. It's not just a sort of put on by Washington and Ottawa to justify a mission. Now, what is, I think, what we should be absolutely crystal clear in our condemnation of is the fact that the policies that the Canadian government and the U.S. government have pushed through the core group, they are principally responsible for the demise of the country. And that's, again, you know, the 2004 coup. I mean, basically what you had in 2004 is you had an attempt to build, and it was a 10-year attempt going back to 94, and you had the Préval government in the late 90s with some efforts to bring somewhat of a functioning judicial system. And, you know, had elections and, you know, relatively fair elections, not perfect, but the best in Haitian history, really. And so you had a whole process of trying to have, you know, a handover of power based upon electoral means, and then you had just the Canadian government backing these violent thugs coming in from the Dominican Republic, U.S. government backing them when they couldn't actually capture Port-au-Prince. You had the Canadian Special Forces with U.S. Marines invading the country to take out the elected president, dumping him in the Central African Republic. But they didn't just take Aristide out. Thousands of elected officials, you know, mayors across the country were all deposed in this coup process. And so you had a huge setting back of the efforts to build a sort of somewhat functioning government with some somewhat human rights standards, judicial system and the like. And then, you know, when the coup, in a sense, was overturned in 2006, which was the election of Préval, was partly an overturn. It was a demonstration that it was an unpopular coup. They, you know, they tried to rig that election in 2006 again with Canada right in the middle of that process. And then you have a Préval government that is trying to sort of reverse a lot of what happened during the two-year, a bit more than two-year coup period. And you know, somewhat successfully, somewhat not successfully. And then you have this horrible earthquake that you know, just completely damaging to Port-au-Prince specifically, but also the surrounding regions. And then you basically use that further weakness of the Haitian state that comes after the earthquake. The U.S. and Canada very clearly use that weakness to, first of all, force an election that should not have happened. The country was not in a place to have an election. And you know, this is, and it's totally ironic that the governments that had a coup government for more than 2 years, you know, they didn't hold immediate elections after Aristide was ousted. They're the ones who are saying, well, oh, we have to have a hurry up election right after this earthquake. You could definitely have postponed that for a year. And then they use the, you know, then again, they intervene in the electoral process. They intervened before the initial vote, but they, you know, by putting money in and all kinds of support for Martelly. But then they, you know, literally intervene and say, we're going to cut off not just aid, right? They weren't just threatening to cut off aid. They were going to cut off all the visas for Préval's family members. They had daughters who were in university in the U.S. and they're like going to cut off visas for the president's family members to go into the U.S. I mean, it was an extremely aggressive forcing of the withdrawal of the Préval candidate, the Unité's political candidate in the election, to put Martelly into the second round. And then 14 years of PHDK rule has just led to the total dissent. So we should be totally clear that the policies of Ottawa and Washington are centrally responsible for the downward spiral of Haiti. The question then becomes is, you know, when you're at that downward spiral, you know, there's no easy out. And like I've said, I think there's a chance that this foreign mission might actually lead to some lessening of insecurity, which would be a positive. But the problem is it reinforces the broader problem, which is the lack of Haitian sovereignty. And so you're reinforcing this damaging dynamic that is central to Haiti's problems.
Yeah, well, and as well as these policies that are nothing if not a determined immiseration of the population in Haiti, there's been a ton of military-grade weaponry that has popped up in the various gangs and that, whether it's through the narco trade or American interests providing these weapons. So, I mean, there's a lot of these guys walking around with very sophisticated weapons that even the military can't claim.
There is, and almost, you know, there's no guns manufactured in Haiti, of course. So all of it's being imported. Some of it does come in from the Dominican, but there's been UN reports that even look at, basically, they're coming from Miami area. They're coming from Florida, South Florida, and there's a lot of accusations. I don't know enough about the matter, but there's a lot of accusations that suggests that the American government isn't really taking that issue too seriously. They could be, you know, clamping down at customs and, you know, searching vessels that were departing to Haiti and the like, that they're not taking that too seriously. So they're not particularly, it seems like they're not particularly disturbed by a constant inflow of weapons into Haiti. And I think that, you know, that's the other side to, you know, I don't think that the insecurity is necessarily in the benefits of Washington and Ottawa. I think that, you know, from the standpoint of the sweatshop interests that companies like Montreal Gildan and, you know, some U.S. companies, you know, using the ultra exploited Haitian women to, you know, stitch T-shirts and the like, that this is not necessarily good for those interests. The insecurity's got to the point where that's, you know, it's bad for a lot of capitalist interests. At the same time, I don't think that the people in Ottawa, or specifically in this case, and people in Washington that may be able to do more to deter the weapons flow, that they particularly care about insecurity in Haiti.
The Canadian government now says for its part that Canada has, this is from a release from Global Affairs, says Canada since 2022 has committed more than $400 million in international assistance funding to Haiti, including emergency food and nutrition, logistical water, sanitation, hygiene, health and protection services, good for when cholera breaks out here, and also $400 million in international assistance funding and investments of $80 million, millions and millions and millions, with the multinational security support mission to Haiti as well getting a big chunk of money, and the Haitian National Police. Is any of this doing any good, or would we be better served to save our money and spend it in Canada?
Well, first of all, I think a decent amount of money, that money is probably spent in Canada, right? When they pay for, you know, like training of other countries' militaries to go to to go to Haiti. I think part of that is funding the Canadians who fly down there, and the Canadian, probably even the salaries of some of the Canadian soldiers and police doing the training. So a lot of that, and probably if you look into a lot of that's going to Canadian NGOs, that is, you know, paying Canadian, you know, Canadians who are either on the ground in Haiti, or you know, even some of their costs in their Montreal office or whatnot. The aid question is always a really tricky one, because I think it's just totally, it would be a very inhumane position to just say, like, cut all aid to Haiti. There are clearly lots of people in Haiti that are dependent on, you know, be it some school that's partly funded by Canada, be it some hospital, or be it some NGO providing some food program. And then even like the what has been a central part of Canadian funding over the past 20 years, the Haitian police. Even defunding the Haitian police right now, as much as the Haitian police is a repressive apparatus, it has had all kinds of links to the gangs, that's very clear. Even defunding the Haitian police right now, I don't think would be a good thing in the, you know, in the short and medium term, because it would just lead to more strength in the hands of gangs who are even, you know, even more repressive, even less responsive necessarily to any sort of democratic structure. Not that the police are that responsive to that either, but so it's a tough situation. I think that when we look at Canadian, if we think of Canadian aid to Haiti as a legitimating tool, a legitimating of Canadian policy in Haiti, in that sense, Canadian aid is very damaging, because that is how it's presented, as we're, you know, providing all kinds of money to help Haitians. But when you actually look into Canadian policy, it's not about helping Haitians. That doesn't mean that there aren't lots of the programs that are funded by these aid initiatives that don't actually help individuals. They do. I think they generally do. But it's also part of the broader undercutting of Haitian sovereignty, which is you know, ultimately quite damaging. So it is. I think it would be, you know, very inhumane to be like, okay, well, yes, this aid is just a tool of imperialism, which it clearly is. But then to lead to that, to then jump to say, well, we should cut it all off like tomorrow. And that's, I think that, you know, the power, the control that Ottawa has to use aid as a tool to advance its policy is very damaging. I think that we should have a system, a global system, kind of more like our transfer payment system in Canada, where, you know, poorer parts of the world get poorer provinces get transfers from the wealthier provinces, and it's relatively like no strings attached. And you know, that's where, of course, that's you know, I'm speaking in some totally theoretical, because it's not on the political agenda at all right now. But that's, you know, so I think the actual transfer of wealth from the wealthier parts of the world to the more impoverished parts is a you know, part of real genuine international solidarity. The problem with aid today is that it's mostly a tool to advance the interests of these countries that clearly don't have the interests of Haitians, or for that matter, you know, Guatemalans or Congolese at heart.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Yves Engler. He is a Montreal-based political activist and the author of 13 books, including Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority, that he and Anthony Fenton worked on many years ago. His latest is co-authored with Owen Schulk, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. We're speaking around Yves' recent article, Canada's Guy in Honduras, Sentenced to 45 years in prison. Well, actually, we haven't got to it yet, so let's get to it now, Yves. Juan Orlando Hernandez. Who is Juan Orlando Hernandez, first of all, Yves?
Yeah, well, he's a former president of Honduras who comes to power in the aftermath of the 2009 coup, which Canada backed. He did something that was exceptional in Honduran politics, which is that he was a two-term president. The Honduran constitution is quite clear in saying there's, you know, one term and that's it. He got the judges that his party had appointed to provide a sort of judicial cover to run again. And then when he ran again, he was losing, when about 70% of the vote was counted, he was losing by 5% or so to the opposition. candidate. And then all of a sudden, the voting stopped for 36 hours. And when it restarted, he was up by a small bit, and he ends up, quote unquote, winning the election. So he was shouldn't have been able to run in the election, and then he rigged the election he shouldn't have been able to run in. Now, from our perspective here in Canada, it's what the Canadian government's response was, which was to immediately endorse him and say this was like a legitimate election. And that was really the continuation of this policy of what Hondurans have dubbed, I guess, 13-year-long neoliberal narco-dictatorship in Honduras that came out of the 2009 coup. And Canada, really, after Washington, was the second backer of that. After Manuel Zelaya was ousted by the military, sent out of the country in his pajamas early in the morning. We just passed the 15th anniversary of that on June 28th. And the Harper government, specifically Peter Kent, who was then the Minister of State for the Americas, he a whole slew of comments just before the coup and just after the coup justified the military's intervention. They laid the groundwork to claim this constitutional, this vote that Zelaya was pushing to have a referendum on whether it should have open up the constitution for change. They framed this as Zelaya's, like, grabbing power and wanting to stay on as president, which is total absurdity. But the Canadian government really pushed that, which is particularly hypocritical then to accept Juan Orlando Hernandez explicitly, running a second term, 10 years later or whatever. But the Harper government backed this coup, didn't cut off any aid, continued its military training assistance program. You had Canadian companies like Gildan that were accused of supporting the coup. The Vancouver based mining company, I'm forgetting the name of the company right now, that was backing the coup. They were busing rights actions had found that busing in people to this pro-coup demonstration a week or 2 weeks after Zelaya's ouster. And so you had this, many Hondurans called this neoliberal narco-dictatorship. And it was known for people who followed the issue, it was known that the Hernandez and his brother, who was a senator, they were involved in the, turning a blind eye and enabling all kinds of drug running through the country into the U.S. It was known that, sort of in the criminal kind of world, but it was, so long as he served our interests. Now, fortunately, Manuel Zelaya's wife won elections about 2 years ago, kind of putting a stop to this neoliberal narco-dictatorship. And the Southern District Court in New York, against the wishes of Washington, it's important to note, they basically, moved forward with this criminal investigation of Juan Orlando Hernandez. And he was convicted. And he was convicted a couple months ago, and then he was sentenced last week to basically the rest of his life in jail for this, his role in this huge criminal enterprise. And now, what's interesting about this is that there will be no attention to this in the Canadian media or really like anywhere, any politician. Our the depth to which we were like working with Juan Orlando Hernandez, or the particularly hypocritical depths, was that Honduras was part of the Lima Group that was claiming that Nicolas Maduro had violated what was ultimately an erroneous interpretation of the Venezuelan constitution, and that Juan Guaido was a legitimate president. So here we had Juan Orlando Hernandez's Honduras demanding that Nicolas Maduro leave, and Juan Guaido was a legitimate president who never was involved in any election, no pretense, was a kind of marginal opposition politician, and claiming this interpretation of the Venezuelan constitution, which was, a dubious interpretation. But Juan Orlando Hernandez, like, he had just flagrantly violated the Honduran constitution. He had then rigged the vote after violating the constitution. So it was this sort of crass kind of like hypocrisy of Canadian policy, and then the guy gets found by the U.S. courts to be this like major drug runner, and we backed him right until the end. His people were coming to ministers from his government, were coming to Ottawa, coming to Montreal, meeting with Trudeau, da 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 da, and Canadian aid continued. There's no critical comments, etc. And then he gets thrown in jail for this long term, and it's like, well, we had nothing to do with it, so why would any Canadian media mention this? Because this is just that bad, Honduran drug president with nothing to do with us. Even though anyone who takes an even cursory look at the last 15 years of Honduran politics knows that at minimum, the U.S. and Canada provided oxygen for the coup. At minimum. And more realistically was, actually actively assisting it, but at minimum kind of went along with the coup by the military. And then it leads into this whole process of narco neoliberal dictatorship, which is then, proven by a U.S. court and the fact that the guy we're backing ends up in jail. But there'll never be, sort of no comment. This is not a comment on Canadian foreign policy, yet it really should be. A comment on Canadian foreign policy. So this becomes a question of the power of imperial media, the power of benevolent Canada mythology, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm sure he's just one bad mango. You, in your article, you cite Tyler Shipley, author of Ottawa and Empire, Canada and the Military Coup in Honduras, as well as Tyler's on this show years ago. But well, Eve, we're fast running out of time, but before we go, I have to recommend everyone go to Eve's site, eveangler.com, to read this article. Canada's guy in Honduras sentenced to 45 years in prison, and some of the other work Eve is doing too, or all of the other work Eve is doing. He's a very busy guy. Patrice Lumumba, his birthday was just this week. Would have been 99 years old had he not been murdered with the assistance, as you point out in your book, Canada and Africa, of the Canadian government. You, in the 1 minute we've got here, Eve, you were out in Montreal today, the Canadian Pension Plan rally. What was that about?
Yeah, the Quebec Pension Plan, in front of the Quebec Pension Plan office, there's been an encampment that was set up about 10 days ago now, demanding they divest from 87 companies. They have about $14 billion in different companies assisting an apartheid state committing genocide in Gaza. And so then today there was a rally sort of as part of the building momentum on this. That the encampment has done. There was a rally in front of the office. The encampment's like about two blocks away. And the encampment's just calling for the pension plan to divest, but also on the Quebec government to stop its just newly opened trade office in Israel. So there's continued opposition to Canada's role, complicity in Israel's Holocaust in Gaza.
Well, there's no quiet summer politically for any of us now. It's too late for that. Thanks a lot, Eve, for coming on again and bringing us up to speed, eh?
Thanks for having me.
My great pleasure. And thanks to go out to Jeremy Kuzmarov. Go and check out Jeremy's work at covertactionmagazine.com. Thanks again, Eve.
Thank you.
Propagating lies while encircled by the soldiers, the starving die. 2 million people without shelter, without food or water, being killed by a regime that bills us for the slaughter. And now watch them justify the missiles that they sent to bomb the starving children dying in their tents since long before October.
Escape the narrative. It's Guerrilla Radio.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.